It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Coming up a little later, an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific call-in poll for UFT members. As we await the results of your tally, how did you vote on the New York City teachers' contract settlement with Mayor de Blasio? But first, after 5 years, the only American prisoner of war from the war in Afghanistan is on his way home. In what's been described as a prisoner exchange, 5 Taliban detainees from Guantanamo were released for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl in a deal brokered by the government of Qatar. It's a deal that's being celebrated and criticized on many fronts. We'll hear about what the release means now with Adam Entis, national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Adam, welcome to WNYC.
It's great to be here.
And you reported today that the secret deal was 3 years in the making. So why now?
Well, last year, the Americans sent a message to the Taliban through its Qatari intermediaries asking for proof of life, evidence that Sergeant Bergdahl was still alive. What they got back was a video that shocked many American officials who saw it. This was not a publicly released video at the time. It was meant only to be shown to the Americans. What they saw was Bergdahl, who was clearly not in good condition. The Americans also assessed that as the drawdown of U.S. forces this year in Afghanistan picked up pace, the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan set to fall to about 9,800 come January. U.S. intelligence assets that are right now involved in the search for Bergdahl will likewise there'll be less of that. So the chances of finding him next year will be a lot less, they assessed. So that was the impetus here for trying to do the deal now.
And listeners, have you been hearing this news over the weekend and the debate around it? Do you have an opinion on whether this was a deal worth making? 212-433-WNYC, does it put more American and other lives in danger than it preserves? In your opinion, 212-433-9692, or if you want to ask a question about the deal of our guest, Adam Entis, national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, 212-433-WNYC. And some Republicans on Capitol Hill are pushing back hard on this swap. Here's Senator John McCain of Arizona on Face the Nation yesterday.
I think there are legitimate questions about these individuals who are being released and the conditions under which they will be released. These are the hardest of the hardcore. These are the highest high-risk people. And others that we have released have gone back into the fight. That's been documented. So, and it's disturbing to me that the Taliban are the ones that named the people to be released.
So that's Senator McCain on CBS Face the Nation yesterday. Adam, he raises a few issues in there. One of them is, are these the hardest of the hardcore, as he characterizes them? I understand their case files were released some time ago by WikiLeaks. So what do we know about them, and is that characterization documentable?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the case files that you're talking about that came out a few years ago do paint a pretty scary picture of these guys. U.S. officials today are a lot more cautious in saying that these 5 detainees pose any threat. In fact, they say that that was overblown. It's really hard to know. These are all, you know, these are not young fighters, for example.
And by the way, they've all been at Gitmo, I understand, all 5 of them, since 2002.
Right. Now, these are not young fighters that are going to go back to Afghanistan anytime soon and pick up a gun and lead an assault on American bases or the Afghan government. If anything, they might provide some kind of symbolic, importance to the Taliban because now that they're free under the deal with Qatar. They're going to be restricted in their movements. They're not going to be allowed for a period of at least a year to leave Qatar.
Of course, part of McCain's argument is that's nothing. That's just 1 year, and they're not restricted in their movements within Qatar. They're just confined from leaving the country, and then they can leave the country a year from now.
Right. Well, Qatar is a small place, and there's really not much for them there to do. There is a small political representation of the Taliban there, who they'll be basically spending their time with during this period of a year. And the assumption is at the end of that year period, if the U.S. doesn't receive evidence in that time that they are actively supporting the Taliban in their military or militant activities. You know, the expectation is that they would eventually return to Afghanistan or Pakistan to be with family and other Taliban members. You know, it's
did,
a legitimate
did the government
debate.
In Afghanistan sign off on this deal? Because I think we confuse a couple of things here potentially when we're talking about people who are members of the Taliban. That has to do with who controls Afghanistan. But when we're thinking about people picked up in general after 9/11, we're talking about al-Qaeda sympathizers or people influenced by al-Qaeda or allied with al-Qaeda who want to attack the United States. So is there any way to know which it is with these guys? And if they're Taliban, did the government of Afghanistan sign off on this as safe for them?
Well, the Americans have had a hard time pretty much since the beginning, since November 2010, when they had the first contacts with the Taliban, to convince the Afghan government, in particular, particularly the President Karzai, that this wasn't an end run around him and a secret effort by the United States to negotiate directly with his enemies and U.S. enemies, the Taliban, to figure out what the future of Afghanistan will look like. That suspicion has been there from the very beginning, and that's why you've seen that the Afghan government has criticized this swap. You know, but a lot of that is driven by, you know, what American officials think is sort of a concern by Karzai himself that the Americans don't like him and are looking for an end run around him, which, you know, in part, we can understand why he might feel that way. Mm-hmm. In this particular case with these five guys, I mean, they are not of the generation of Taliban that we've been fighting for the last 10 years, 13 years in Afghanistan. These guys had positions of authority in the Taliban government that existed before the U.S. came in and kicked the Taliban out. They are not; these are not the suicide bombers that we've seen in Kabul and places like that. This is a different variety, a different flavor of Taliban.
The paleo Taliban. You're listening to WNYC FM HD in AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, as we talk about the U.S. and Taliban in a prisoner exchange. And John in Somerset County, you're on WNYC. Hiya, John.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning. Thank you for having me on. I was curious to find out if there are any precedents for having previously negotiated prisoner exchanges between either the Taliban with the United States or with any other terrorist networks or perhaps another government with the same.
For the U.S., this is definitely an unprecedented way this was done, no question about that. There have been previous exchanges in the past that have been a lot less high profile. If you look internationally, you'll notice that Israel pretty often, not pretty often, but occasionally does swaps like this. They did it to get a soldier that was being held captive in Gaza a couple years ago, and they did it to get bodies back from Hezbollah, where they negotiated and released some very wanted Hezbollah-connected convicted terrorists that were in Israeli prison, some very high-profile people, in order to get bodies back of dead Israeli soldiers. So there is a precedent out there. I think in the United States, obviously, it's very controversial. In places like Israel, it's less controversial. And Israel's policy on this has always been that you have to bring everybody back, even if they're no longer alive. And that's been a hardcore policy of the Israelis, which is controversial also in that country.
Is it out of respect for the individual Israeli or the individual American, even if it theoretically puts other people at risk? and encourages terrorism on one level because they think that they can get future prisoner exchanges?
Yeah, they take a very. There is a little bit of a religious underpinning to this, but it's also there. This is an army that is made up of everybody having to serve. It's not a volunteer army like the United States has, and the state really puts a premium on saying to the mothers who have to send all of their children off to fight or to serve in the Israeli military that their government is going to go to great lengths to get them back.
Mm-hmm.
So I think compared to the United States, a bit of a more practical approach to negotiating with their enemies. Israel doesn't negotiate directly with Hamas and doesn't negotiate, as far as we know, directly with Hezbollah. But they have what we call cutouts, people who would negotiate kind of as intermediaries, kind of what happened here with Qatar, to try to bring about those transfers and trades.
And so here's a clip of White House National Security Advisor Susan Rice on CNN yesterday referring to this question of negotiating with terrorists.
If we got into a situation where we said, you know, because of who has captured an American soldier on the battlefield, we will leave that person behind, we would be in a whole new era for the safety of our personnel and for the nature of our commitment to our men and women in uniform.
Sure.
So because it was the Taliban that had him did not mean that we had any less of an obligation to bring him back.
Susan Rice, the White House National Security Advisor. So, how about Melanie in Westbury? You're on WNYC. Hello, Melanie.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. What are you thinking?
I think that last quote that you used really summed it up very well. I think I hear a lot of people who say, you know, we don't negotiate with terrorists. And I think terrorist has become kind of a buzzword for our general enemy. But the main point that I wanted to make to keep it succinct is you only negotiate with your enemies. And if you're in a situation where you're at war, then tensions are going to be high. But you don't make peace with your friends. You make peace with your enemies. Now, by no stretch am I trying to say that this is a matter of making peace, but you know, sometimes we have to do things that make us uncomfortable in a moral sense when we attack. So sometimes we also have to do things that make us uncomfortable.
Well, the critics would say it's not a question of morality. It's a question of pragmatism, that if you do something like this and we capture more Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whoever it is, it encourages those groups to take more Americans as prisoners if they think we'll make those deals with them. Are you concerned about that at all?
Well, okay. That's a really, really great point, in my opinion. And the way that I would respond to that is that our entire objection to dealing with these people is the aspect of terror. So there is a drive for them to do that regardless of whether or not they get something out of it. This is what they are doing. And whether or not they've had success with it for the past 14 years or not, they've continued to do it. I don't think that it negates our obligation to our troops to do what we can to get them back if they're in trouble.
Do you
feel like that answers the question?
Yeah, it answers it enough to forward the conversation. And Melanie, thank you very much. So does this, in a way, kind of to her point, Adam Antis, national security correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, is this an indication that the Taliban, at least, not to speak for all groups that we would consider Islamist radical terrorist groups or whatever words you want to use, but that the Taliban is somehow regularizing itself into a kind of army rather than a group of illegal enemy combatants, as Dick Cheney might have said, and willing to negotiate as kind of a political actor rather than a group that's completely outside the power structure that only wants to do things like attack the World Trade Center to make a point?
Right. Well, I think that's an excellent point. And for the Americans that were negotiating the deal, their main takeaway from this was how remarkably well organized, how coherent, how straightforward the Taliban were during these negotiations. This was a very complex, well choreographed deal that had to be negotiated to the point where a Taliban leader had to call the cell phone of the head of the special operations team and tell him where he was supposed to fly to come pick up Sergeant Bergdahl. This was a very complex deal, and it went like clockwork. The Americans were very impressed by that. And many of the negotiators that I've spoken to over the last couple of days, what they say is this provides potentially a foundation to think that the U.S. can negotiate in the future on other complex deals with this leadership, which has shown through this swap that it has the command and control over and leadership decision making abilities that would allow it to be a potential partner down the road.
And I want to ask you about a word here, and the word is prisoner. Media reports are tending to call this, in some cases, a POW exchange, a prisoner of war exchange. Maybe that's just elements of the media being, you know, imprecise, but referring to the people on both sides of this as prisoners of war, which is a term that the United States would never have used in the past for terrorism detainees. Here's Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel on Meet the Press yesterday. This is as close as he comes, and this is just 8 seconds.
Sergeant Bergdahl is a member of the United States Army. This was a prisoner exchange.
This was a prisoner exchange. Do you find any meaning in his use of the word prisoner rather than detainee or illegal enemy combatant or terrorist?
Yeah, no, I think that within the U.S. government, they understand the Taliban took Sergeant Bergdahl 5 years ago. He probably was handed over to a group that's known as the Haqqani Network, where he was held for a period of time. And that's a group that the U.S. clearly views as a hardcore al-Qaeda-linked terrorist organization. They are drawing a distinction here between al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And that is an important distinction that's being made, and it's an important distinction that can kind of take you down the road to a period where if the Afghan government, the future Afghan government, is prepared to sit down and talk with the Taliban, we might be prepared to kind of work to try to bring that together to a point where the Taliban, what they really clearly are craving here is recognition. They want to come in from the cold, basically, and that's what this deal sort of flexes at down the road.
Because it makes me also wonder whether this doesn't represent the beginning of a shift in U.S. characterization of any detainees in the war on terror. They never wanted to call them prisoners of war, even in the either in the Bush administration or in the Obama administration. But then they'd fall through the cracks of any legal definition. And the rest of the world largely thought we've been in violation of the Geneva Convention because we treat people who we capture on the battlefield as, you know, in no legal status at all. So if we start calling them prisoners, maybe that starts to move away from the Bush-Cheney model even further. Or am I reading too much into it?
Well, I think this is very specific to this case. If Al-Qaeda in Syria, for example, were to get an American somewhere, I don't think we'd be calling that person a prisoner of war. In the case of the Taliban, there has been a slow effort by the U.S. to regularize that relationship. For example, last summer, the U.S. helped broker a deal to open a Taliban political office in Qatar. Effectively, that would be their foreign ministry. It didn't work out. That deal fell through literally the day that it was reached and the office had opened. But there has been a slow movement towards a more normal relationship between the United States and the Taliban, in the sense that, yes, we are fighting them in Afghanistan on the ground, but we're beginning to recognize that they do have a leadership that that does want to have a diplomatic representation, and they are looking to reach out and have discussions with the United States about maybe one day moving to a different place. At least that's the hope that many American officials are taking away from this Bergdahl exchange.
Particular to the Taliban and the future of Afghanistan. As we talk about this prisoner exchange between the U.S. and the Taliban, 5 Guantanamo detainees there since 2002 now being released to the nation of Qatar in exchange for the one American being held as a prisoner of war in Afghanistan. And Yvonne in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Yvonne.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My question was, I was wondering if the fact that the American soldier who was returned to us may be both a deserter and mentally unstable, who originally tried to join the French forces and was rejected by them because he was seen as too mentally unstable, and whether he may be seen as too much of a loose cannon and actually more of a threat to us there than the people we were releasing in exchange.
Huh. Well, the circumstances of his capture are kind of murky, right? I mean, he kind of, deserter would be too strong, I think, but he kind of, or maybe it isn't, I have no idea, but he kind of walked away from his base in Afghanistan, right, and was wandering around. What's the story of how this guy got captured in the first place?
It's still murky. American officials now are trying to piece that together in a more clear way now that they actually have access to Sergeant Bergdahl to get his version of events. Some of his soldiers who are with him tell stories. One of them, for example, tells the story that just before he walked out of his camp, he had mailed home all of his equipment, including his laptop computer and all of his personal effects, and that soldier who was in his unit thought that was a sign that he was getting ready to leave. You know, he had no intention of going home. He was going to be a deserter. At this point, these are unverified, in my opinion, accounts that need further examination. The military needs to try to get to the bottom, talk to him, figure out what he was doing. There are a lot of stories out there that I personally have not been able to verify, and I'd rather not propagate rumors that to that effect. So I think we're going to have to wait and see over time what information the American service members are able to glean during their interviews with Bergdahl now that he's out, and maybe in a few weeks' time after he's back in the United States, he'll start doing interviews and help explain himself what he was thinking at that time.
And they may learn what he was thinking at that time, but maybe this also just represents the American government's commitment to the one American who's being held as a prisoner of war in Afghanistan. Even if he was a borderline deserter, he's still an American who was in captivity.
Right. No, there's no question that for the policymakers that had to make this decision, that was the main issue at stake. And I think second to that was kind of a test of concept to see whether or not the U.S. could have a complex negotiation through a third party with the Taliban. So those are the two things that the U.S. government is taking away from this. They got Bergdahl out successfully, and they've had discussions successfully with the Taliban through a third party. I think for this administration, they're very happy with the results of this effort.
Let me throw in one final question, and that is, did the Obama administration act in an autocratic and illegal way in even consummating this deal? Because another layer of criticism from the Republicans is that the law requires the Secretary of Defense to inform certain congressional committees 30 days before there are any prisoner transfers, but they were only notified of this deal after the release of the prisoners. Susan Rice says time is of the essence because Bergdahl was in bad health. But are these releases subject to a vote? Is it clear that the Obama administration was within the law, or perhaps clear that it actually broke the law with this release of prisoners from Gitmo?
Well, I'm not sure it's clear that they broke the law in the sense that, there are waiver authorities and abilities that the president has to sidestep some clear language that's in the law. In this particular case, it's unquestionable that the White House was supposed to provide a notification, a 30-day notification to Congress. That's part of a law that was passed in, I believe, 2010, late 2010. Now, in this particular case, previous negotiations over Bergdahl have collapsed because of leaks. So the leaks that basically prompted the government in Karzai to throw a fit, the government in Kabul to throw a fit, and other leaks which prompted the Taliban to pull out of the negotiations. So there was a real sensitivity within the administration and concern that if they did notify Congress, it would leak out. If they gave them 30 days, it would trigger a debate that might jeopardize the deal. So there was a sense this was very fast-moving, very, very delicate. If it really did take place over a period of about 4 days for them to actually carry out this operation. So to have it sitting on the Hill for discussion, even supposedly behind doors, for the administration raised too many question marks.
Adam Entis, Wall Street Journal national security correspondent, thanks for clarifying so much of this for us today.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, RX for the BX, Prescription for the Bronx, the new WNYC series that premiered on Morning Edition. Our contribution today, how Obamacare and Medicaid reform are changing life for home health care aides and their patients. Stay with us.